From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, poet Miller Williams. He follows in the tradition of Robert Frost, James Dickey, and Maya Angelou when he reads one of his poems at President Clinton's inaugural ceremony today. A resident of Arkansas, Miller Williams has known the Clintons since the 70s and is a longtime friend of another Southern statesman, former President Jimmy Carter. Also, on this Martin Luther King Day, we talk with Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. about racial inequality in America. He served as a federal judge for almost 3 decades, including a term as Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. His new book about race and the American legal process is Shades of Freedom. And Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by producer Babyface. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. President Clinton has chosen a fellow Arkansas native and the poetry mentor of former President Jimmy Carter to read a poem during his inaugural ceremony today. Miller Williams is a professor of English and foreign languages and director of the University of Arkansas Press. He's written more than 10 volumes of poetry, among them Living on the Surface, Points of Departure, and Adjusting to the Light. One critic describes Williams as a poet of the solidly down-to-earth, whose characters most often muse on day-to-day practicalities, even when confronting the great mysteries of life and death. Miller Williams' new collection, which will include his inaugural poem, is The Ways We Touch. I asked him to read a poem from his book, Living on the Surface. This is Miller Williams reading a poem for Emily.
Small fact and fingers, and farthest one from me, a hand's width and 2 generations away, in this still present, I am 53, you are not yet a full day. When I am 63, when you are 10, and you are neither closer nor as far, your arms will fill with what you know by then, the arithmetic and love we do and are. When I by blood and luck am 86, and you are someplace else in 33, believing in sex and God and politics, with children who look not at all like me. Sometime I know you will have read them this, so they will know I love them and say so, and love their mother. Child, whatever is always or never was. Long ago, a day I watched a while beside your bed, I wrote this down, a thing that might be kept a while, to tell you what I would have said, when you were who knows what, and I was dead, which is, I stood and loved you while you slept.
Miller Williams, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm curious if lines of poems and poems come to you in the way that it appears in this poem, just in the course of a day, sitting by a child's bedside or driving your car.
The beginnings come to me that way. A synapse will fire and a couple of words will cling together. Sometimes a rhythm will begin to form. But the poems come much more slowly and sometimes more agonizingly than that. This poem, A Poem for Emily, is in a number of textbooks and anthologies. In one of those textbooks, the editor adds a note saying, "This poem was written as the poet stood at the side of his granddaughter's crib on the day of her birth." It, of course, wasn't. No poem was ever written under such circumstances in such a moment. I got the idea then. The poem was finished 3 yellow legal pads and 6 months later.
But do you try to preserve the feeling and the emotion and the impetus for the poem as it arose out of a moment?
That's the whole point of writing poetry. There is an expression that I hope won't be misunderstood in poetry, to write drunk and revise sober. That is to say, go with the wild inspiration of the moment that hits you in the belly and reels your brain. But as the craftsman comes in, and the engineer of language begins to work, the poem takes its formal shape. But that first passion must not be lost while the poet is doing this. It very often is, and the poem ends up in the wastebasket. And the great challenge of writing poetry, for me, is to hold that passion while you build the construct of the craft.
What kind or kinds of poetry do you most enjoy? And I'm thinking that you said somewhere that you like the kind of poetry that dogs and cats can understand.
This is a line from the poet Marianne Moore. I want to give her credit for it. But I agree with her, yes. I want to write poems that dogs and cats can understand. I like to read that kind. That is to say, the mystery in a poem should not lie in a confusion about the dramatic situation of the poem. It seems to me that when a person reads through a poem, the reader should understand who, what, where, and when as clearly as journalists are taught to make that accessible in the first reading of the first paragraph. The why, no, not in the poetry. Why is part of the mystery of the poem, not all of it, but part of it. But I want someone to know when they read a poem for Emily that this is not about taking out the trash or walking the dog. This is about standing there by the crib of a newborn baby. There is a fad abroad in the land that says that a poem should be solved rather than read. If I want to solve something, I'll go to the New York Times double acrostic. I want to engage a poem on a deeper level than that. And the mystery in a poem lies under the dramatic situation. It's very easy to make the dramatic situation unclear. And we should be wary of what's too easy.
I suppose if you're clear about what the who, the what, and the where, and the when is, then you're freer to think and ponder the why.
Exactly, and you're freer to let the mystery lie in such things as why a teacher might say to a seventh grade class or an 11th grade class, why did he say sex and God and politics? What do those three things have in common? Why this triangulation of human concern, sex, God, and politics? What does that embody in our society? There's the mystery, part of the mystery, not what the dramatic situation is.
Well, your task, of course, in the last few weeks has been to write an inaugural poem. Has your writing process changed at all under deadline?
Well, yes, it's had to be a little more controlled and not so fortuitous. Usually, I will see something, an interesting contrast, or hear a rhythm of speech, or hear a story that triggers the creative process, and I simply go with it. Quite often, I don't know what a poem is going to be about until I finish it, because I don't really care. I have no commission. But when a poem has been commissioned, when one is asked to write what we call an occasional poem, a poem written for an occasion, there has to be more control. One has to keep the poem on the subject and finish it in time. This is not the first occasional poem I've written. When Jimmy Carter was defeated, his family and friends asked me to write a poem to be read to welcome him home to Plains, and I had about a month to do that. The poet Jim Whitehead also was asked to write one, and we read together. When Senator Fulbright was dying, his family and friends asked me if I would write a poem to be read as an elegy at his funeral, which I did. I only had 4 days for that one, and it certainly had to be narrowly focused in terms of what it said. I've had a month. I will have had a month for this one. What I do is put myself into a place, a spiritual and physical place, which I've learned over the years is more likely to make the juices flow and the synapses fire. And specifically for me, this is not going to be true, I guess, for any other poet, but for me, I like to sit in my office, my study, in my home on an Ozarks hillside with the rest of the house asleep and one light burning over my left shoulder, a lap board in my lap, my little Shih Tzu asleep on the footstool between my shoes, and a gentle, maybe something from the gentle side of John Coltrane playing on the CD player, and a yellow legal pad and a real fountain pen in my hand, and I start scribbling. And I can think perhaps of a dressmaker who is told to design, to have a gown ready in a week or a month. She might simply, if she's got a lot of experience and knows the craft, she might put herself in the right place, take a bolt of material and some scissors, and just start cutting. And I'm bound to believe that the inspiration is going to be dragged behind those scissors into that fabric. If I just start writing under such circumstances and try to keep my mind on what we're concerned with, the inspiration seems to find my fountain pen.
My guest is Miller Williams. He's a poet and a professor of English and foreign languages at the University of Arkansas. He's been chosen by President Clinton to deliver a poem during today's presidential inauguration. Miller Williams' collections of poetry include Living on the Surface and Adjusting to the Light. His latest work, The Ways We Touch, is just being released next week. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Miller Williams. He was picked by President Clinton to deliver today's inaugural poem. Your father was a Methodist minister, and you call him one of the last great pulpit orators. Did he have a very lyrical style on the pulpit?
Yeah, he sounded, when he talked in the pulpit, he sounded almost biblical. Almost as if he were reading from the King James Bible, no matter what he might be reading. Well, Dylan Thomas could do this. The Welsh poet Dylan Thomas could read the phone book, I think, and bring tears to your eyes. Some people do that. I think my father was in that class, yeah.
Your father also seemed to be quite a progressive, radical thinker for his day. He worked to achieve integration of the church in the 40s. He preached equal rights for women. He argued against censorship in the arts and the press. How did he fit into society in the South?
Well, I'm not sure how well he did fit in. He had a number of times people threatened to beat him up, and he and my mother were pulled out of the house by a Knight Rider sort of a fellow with a shotgun one time for this kind of thing. He, however, was extremely popular with his parishioners, partly because he was such a fine minister, a preacher, but also he was one of the best counselors I've ever known. People with personal problems, marital problems or problems of education or depression or whatever, found great help in his study at the church. This gave him a foundation, a little bit of protection. He did offer two or three times to turn his credentials in to the Methodist Church, which is the church's way of saying retire, resign, and was told that they needed him. He said, "But I don't believe. I'm not sure that I can believe in the virgin birth and the resurrection as I did when I was young." And he was told that he could use metaphors. Truth crushed to earth will rise again, this kind of thing. That finally wasn't enough for him, and he did retire early from the church. He, I think, so far as I know, led the first interracial sit-in in the South in 1946 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, at a drugstore soda fountain. He and a black minister in Fort Smith brought their two Methodist youth fellowships together and simply walked down there and ordered Cokes. So far as I know, there had not been a sit-in before 1946.
Did this kind of activity, and also probably the fact that you moved around a lot from parish to parish, have repercussions on you as a kid?
Before I respond directly to that, let me say that I had not mentioned the fact that we did move every 2 to 4 years. That helped a little bit also in getting us out of town before he could get himself in really serious trouble each time. We were raised with the expectation that we would respect all authority when it came to knowledge and experience, and we would challenge all authority when it came to principle, and examine it before we obeyed it, before we accepted it, and not to accept it automatically. I was involved in that little sit-in, but when I was in college and in graduate school, I was involved in the civil rights movement in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, and my parents would have been embarrassed had I not been. I was the age to be, and the cause was there. I didn't have to be drafted.
When you went to college, and in those days you had to give a profile to the college psychologist, and then they would determine what your talents were, apparently, you said you wanted to write and major in English, yeah. But the psychologist disagreed. What did he say about your writing aspirations?
This is one of the times when my parents' teachings got me into trouble. You see, as I mentioned earlier, I was taught to obey authority, to respect authority when it had to do with knowledge, and I assumed that this professor of psychology knew more than I did about this field. There was no real principle involved. There was simply a matter that he was my academic superior and knew more. He told me that I was going to embarrass my parents if I tried to go on into English because I was nonverbal. And that the best I could do was to get over in the hard sciences and try to make a scientist of myself where I wouldn't have to use a lot of words. And I immediately changed my major in my first semester from English to chemistry and biology, and went on through almost to my doctorate and taught that on the college level for at least a dozen years before it occurred to me and to my superiors that I was doing all my publication in the humanities.
How would you say your science background informs your writing?
I believe, and others have said this, that there is an insistence in my poetry on the particular, on the detail. I'm uneasy with abstraction and generality. I want something that works on the senses. And in fact, there is University of Missouri Press published a book on my work called Miller Williams and the Poetry of the Particular. They meant particular in that sense. And the poetry of things you can feel, touch, look at, and I can't imagine a title that would have pleased me more.
You have had a pretty long association with former President Jimmy Carter, and he pretty much, is this right, asked you to help him get started writing poetry?
Right, that's a public story, yeah. I was in Plains one time when we were having a dinner in Sybil Carter's restaurant, a little cafe owned by Billy's widow. And he scooted his chair over and said, if somebody older than most who would ask this question were interested in learning to write poetry, where would he start? And I said, well, I guess he'd start by asking me that question. And I gave him some things I thought he might profitably read and ask him to send me what he wrote as he worked on it, and he did. We talked later in Plains and in the residence at the Carter Center in Atlanta. He flew over to Fayetteville here to spend a weekend and chat about the poetry.
So how blunt were you with him about his writing? If you didn't like something, or if you really felt something was flawed, did you say, you know, President Carter, this stinks?
As a matter of fact, a shift in our relationship, I hope for the better, came about under such a circumstance. We were sitting in the residence, in the breakfast room of the residence at the Carter Center, about 11 o'clock at night, looking over some poems, and I said something like, but Mr. President, that makes the line too long. And he looked at me and he said, don't call me Mr. President. I said, well, it would make me very nervous. What should I call you? He said, call me Jimmy. I'm your student. And I said, he said, it makes me very nervous for you to call me Mr. President when you're teaching me. And I said, well, it makes me very nervous to call you Jimmy. And he looked at me and said, with presidential authority, which one of us is going to be nervous then? And that settled it. I said, I guess I am, Jimmy. And from then on, it was Jimmy and Miller, and it's become very comfortable. He sent me an email when he learned that I would be doing the inaugural poem, and said with a endearing sense of irony, he said, let me know if you need help.
Didn't you take him up on it?
No, I just thanked him for the note.
Miller Williams' new collection of poetry is The Ways We Touch. It's due out next week from the University of Illinois Press. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
The very thought of you makes my heart sing.
Coming up, Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. recalls his experiences growing up in the segregated North and talks about the ways in which racism has been institutionalized in the American legal system. And Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by record producer Babyface. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On this Martin Luther King Day, we've invited jurist and civil rights leader Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. to talk about his perspective on race relations and the law in America. After attending segregated schools in Trenton, New Jersey, Higginbotham graduated with honors from Yale Law School in 1951. He then applied to and was rejected by every major law firm in Philadelphia because of the color of his skin. He went into public service and at the age of 36 was appointed by President Kennedy to the federal bench. Judge Higginbotham retired in 1993 after 29 years on the bench, including a term as the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He currently teaches law at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book, Shades of Freedom, is the second in a series on race and the American legal process. In it, Judge Higginbotham cites the slave statutes of the 1600s, the Dred Scott case, and Plessy v. Ferguson as examples of the ways in which, more often than not, the American legal process has played a dominant role in, as he writes, substantiating, perpetuating, and legitimizing the precept of black inferiority. I asked him to explain the relevance of those historical legal precedents in today's world.
Well, what it has to do with now is that some of the same perceptions which sanctioned slavery law were predicated on the assumption that blacks were inferior and you could treat them differently. And today you have a significant portion of the society which looks upon blacks as inferior and therefore that they can be treated adversely. I discuss, as an example, the Susan Smith case out of Union, South Carolina in 1994, where when she rolled her car down into the river with her two children, went on the air and said that a black man did it. And I have a whole series of cases from South Carolina to Boston where whites who've been involved in the commission of crimes have claimed that a black was involved when no such black was. So that if you look at the current data in the 1990s with the large number of false accusations which have been made against blacks, and I have them documented in the book, why do they do it? No one says a Roman Catholic did it, and no one says a Methodist did it, but you have this plethora of cases which say that a black did it, when we learn later they never did. And the reason why that occurs is that you've got a mindset that blacks are still perceived by some people as inferior and therefore can be treated differently.
Well, someone might say, well, what does that have to do with our legal system, though? That speaks to individual racism or even perhaps a pervasive social bias.
Well, but I guess it depends on which side of the lens you're looking at. If you were in Boston when Charles Stewart claimed that his wife had been killed by a black, and if you had been in Boston when thereafter in predominantly black neighborhoods, there were hundreds of searches and arrests, and some arrests were made. And if you were in towns where people were literally taken to the police station, that is something more than just a mere legal coincidence. It is the utilization of the law predicated on presumptions of prejudice to treat you adversely because of your race. So prejudice, to some extent, still persists, and it is that bias which is predicated on the same type of thinking which said you could treat them differently and make them slaves.
You grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. Your mother was a maid, and your father was a factory worker. And you were the first student from your segregated grammar school to graduate to the academic track at Trenton's junior high. How did you accomplish that?
Well, you had to have second year Latin to enter the academic program at what was then called the Lincoln Junior High School, an all-black school. But since we did not have Latin, it would mean that I would have to go in the industrial program. But my mother went to see the principal. The principal said it couldn't be done because I had not had first-year Latin. My mother begged him to give me an opportunity, saying she was confident that I'd be able to make it. So I entered the academic program where I started with second-year Latin, not having had the first year.
That's not that easy, is it?
It certainly wasn't.
Well, what did your mother hope for you?
Well, my mother had a minimum education, maybe a maximum of sixth grade Virginia education. My mother was the most inspiring person I've ever known, and she disregarded the probability curve. My mother believed in America in a sense that even with all of its obstacles, that if you give your society the very, very best and that you're steadfast, that somewhere God will make a way. So that she convinced me from the time I was 3 or 4 years old to really give it nothing less than my best. And I think that having a mother who had that type of commitment had a profound impact on me so that I could face obstacles and not feel overcome.
Well, you got into Purdue University, and at that time there were 6,000 whites and 12 blacks, and they had a kind of segregated housing arrangement for the black students, which I imagine sounds quite wretched. You asked the president of the university for a section of any dorm just for the 12 of you that had some heat. What was his response?
Well, we slept in an attic with no heat. And you can imagine, and when the temperature got 20 and 15, how miserable. And his response was, look, Higginbotham, the law does not require us to have you here, and you either take it or leave it. I finished my semester there, and I did well academically, and I transferred. And I did more than merely transfer from Purdue, which I'd entered when I was 16 and was studying engineering. I decided that I would go into the law because I wanted to, in my life, make a change so that my children would not face another president such as Dr. Elliott, who was willing to preclude us from equality at Purdue.
So he made you a lawyer?
He certainly did. I would have been an engineer but for him.
You graduated from Yale Law School. You were a star of the debate team. You had high recommendations, and the dean of the school sent you with recommendations to the Yale Law School representative in Philadelphia. Did the representative know you were black?
No, he did not. In fact, he wrote me a letter commending me on my record and said my problem would be to decide which firm I would want to go to. When I got there in December, when he met me, he didn't even ask me to sit down. He left me standing in front of his desk, and he said, well, Higginbotham, there's nothing I can do for you, but I can give you the name of two black lawyers, and that was the end of the conversation. But I don't want to give a negative on all of these, though all of the law firms refused to take me and refused a couple years earlier to take Bill Coleman, who had clerked for the United States Supreme Court Justice. I did have a great fortune in the sense that there was a Quaker judge, Judge Curtis Bach, who, when he got my papers, looked at them and hired me on the spot. And Judge Bach made a profound difference. He is the father of Derek Bach, the former president of Harvard, so that I would like for you to clearly understand that when I discuss the deficiencies in race relations in America, I am aware of many of the strengths, and I'm aware of the significant number of people of goodwill who have made a profound contribution into bridging the gaps so that the history of the past will not be the prologue of the future.
Later in the 50s and the early 60s, as the height of the civil rights movement, and you were established in your career, you once said of that period that you recognized you had to be a voice of rationality for your generation rather than a voice of anger, that if you want change, that that's how you do it. Was that a difficult decision for you to make, or a difficult line to walk?
No, it was not. If you could just turn the clock back to 1968 as an example, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and you saw the cities burning down in Newark and in Chicago and in 10 blocks from the White House in Washington, you recognize that we were caught in a reaction of violence to the killing of the nonviolent prophet, that America could disintegrate. And so that it was absolutely essential that those of us who had leadership roles would speak jointly by saying we condemned racism, but we also condemned violence, one, because it's inappropriate, and secondly, because it's nonproductive. I was confident then, and I'm even more confident now, that violence is not a rational way of resolution, and that those who participate in it in the long run are counterproductive. So that I try to do two things. One, to condemn the racism and the sexism and the mistreatment of people because who are weak and poor, so that you make clear that you know what rights they should get. At the same time, make it also clear of my opposition to using violence as an option to make change.
You know, I think about you working every day in the courts, upholding the law, I suppose revering the laws of this country in your capacity as a jurist, and then going back to your office and working on a history of the ways in which the legal system in America institutionalized racial oppression and prejudice throughout history. Was that in some way a schizophrenic experience? For you.
Well, for some people, it could be. I look upon it as an individual who worked as a pathologist, looking through lens, seeing tissue that was malignant, and then at the same time working for a process so that you can eliminate the malignancy. So that I think that after 33 years of looking at it, that I became more like the pathologist and did not let my emotions affect me, but tried to see what was wrong and then to try to figure out what are the therapeutic or prophylactic ways under which that pathology could be eliminated.
My guest is Judge Leon Higginbotham, Jr. He served for 29 years as a federal judge and is a former chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. His new book, Shades of Freedom, traces racism and the law in this country since colonial times. It's the second volume in a projected series on race and the American legal process. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Judge Leon Higginbotham, Jr. He retired from the bench in 1993 after serving as a federal judge for 29 years, most recently as the chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He currently teaches law at Harvard University. You expressed grave reservations about Justice Clarence Thomas in an open letter to him at the time of his confirmation. What most alarmed you about his views and his potential as a Supreme Court jurist?
Well, what alarmed me most was that he had, while he was with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, written a whole series of articles critiquing and I think impugning Justice Thurgood Marshall. And I felt that anyone who had been the beneficiary of the constitutional system, which Thurgood Marshall, as counsel for the NAACP, laid the groundwork for, and as a Supreme Court justice, had pushed to implement, that anyone who had been so critical of him might, when they get on the court, be insensitive to the plight of the weak, the poor, and the blacks, because otherwise you could not explain why he would have been so critical of Justice Marshall.
Although you intimate that it might have been motivated by his political alliance.
It may very well have been. He may very well have thought that in order to be in good standing with the Reagan and Bush people, I have to sort of impugn my own people. Well, if he did it for that, that's an even more of a reason why I would be concerned about his appointment to the court. I think that there's nothing worse than to have someone who's been the beneficiary of options to now, in order to advance himself or herself, to now push to eliminate the same options for others who are in as great a need.
Well, what do you make of arguments on the part of whites or blacks against affirmative action? And I'm thinking that some black conservatives argue that affirmative action was meant to be temporary and that it's like treating a patient with aspirin instead of a cure, that what African Americans need are better city schools so that black college and job applicants are truly on equal footing with whites and equally qualified to compete.
Well, first of all, you've got to throw out the myth that all the white people who've made it into society have been quality people. Secondly, let's look at Newt Gingrich.
Okay.
A year ago, he brought in 65 pages to the United States Congress. Of the 65, 64 were white and one was Asian. Prior to that, about 20% who had come in had been minorities. Now, is Newt Gingrich saying to us that there's not one black boy in this country who can carry a flag? Is Newt Gingrich saying to us that there's not one black girl who can deliver a message? The truth of the matter is, the reason why you need affirmative action is because of the type of process which is run by people like Newt Gingrich. If you don't have affirmative action, you're going to have affirmative exclusion. If you look at what is known as the Sixth Circuit, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan, and Tennessee, the Reagan and Bush administration, over a period of 12 years, appointed 50 judges. Of the 50, not one was black. Carter had been able to appoint blacks. Nixon had. Ford hat, a Kennedy hat. The reason why you have to have affirmative action is because there's sufficient latent prejudice and bias in the system that the only way you're going to get equilibrium is to have some monitoring so that there is some inclusion. And what I can't understand is that how is it that people can be so comfortable with black athletes getting into the schools, sometimes through an affirmative athletic policy, but the black student who could be a good scientist, who could be a good mathematician, you say that you don't want to have any affirmative recruiting policies for them.
Judge Higginbotham, I'm really sorry we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking today.
My pleasure.
Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. teaches law at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book is Shades of Freedom. The Smithsonian Institution has just reissued a collection called Voices of the Civil Rights Movement, Black American Freedom Songs, recorded between 1960 and 1966. This is We Are Soldiers in the Army, recorded in 1963 at a civil rights meeting in Danville, Virginia. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by producer Babyface. This is Fresh Air. When the Grammy nominations were announced recently, Kenneth Babyface Edmonds found himself nominated 12 times, tying the all-time record with Michael Jackson. Babyface got most of his nominations for producing and writing the soundtrack album for Waiting to Exhale. He supplied material for performers as varied as Whitney Houston, Eric Clapton, and Madonna. He's had 51 songs in the top 10, 16 of them going to number one. Yet rock critic Ken Tucker thinks Babyface's new solo album, called The Day, isn't getting the kind of attention it deserves.
Girl, it's been a long, long time coming, yes it has. But I know that it's been worth the wait, yeah. Yeah. It feels like springtime in winter. It feels like Christmas.
New York Times recently called him the soul man of suburbia, and for once a New York Times headline wasn't merely banal. If gangster rap represents a kind of youth revolt, the suave, elegant R&B of Babyface is the new soundtrack for a middle class looking to be comforted and reassured. Comfort and reassurance are frequently the inspirations for lots of passive, watery pop music, but for Babyface, they're nothing less than holy grails, goals to be attained through faith in work that reveals simple beauty.
I was born on the north side of a Midwestern town. There was 9 of us living in a 3-bedroom house, yeah. Didn't have much money, yeah. We made do, 'cause mama worked all day long and daddy did too. Did all they could, made sure we had clothes and food, yeah. Went to public schools and we followed public rules. We used secondhand books, oh, I didn't mind the books. Mama taught us early in life, everybody's got
It's obvious that Babyface is working within a tradition, that of the smooth soul balladeer. There's a lot of Smokey Robinson and Al Green in his voice. Babyface's acknowledged idol, Stevie Wonder, sings a duet with him on this new album. Like the music made by those men, Babyface's songs transcend lovey-dovey cliches through a quiet intensity of conviction. But one reason I like this album so much is that it also represents Babyface's break with that tradition, a striking out on his own. One of the best songs on the day is also one of its least typical. It's called Talk to Me and uses an acoustic guitar as its hook and finds Babyface lowering his voice to an Elvis Presley-ish growl to achieve his usual intimacy.
What must I say to you to get inside your head, yeah? Why must you always think I want to get in your face, yeah? Why always gotta be closest thing wrong, yeah. Sometimes the only thing a brother need, he need a woman to be strong. I ain't crying, done about run out of tears. But you're the closest thing to heaven, I need you to be near. Hear me, dog, I can't make it more clear. The only thing that's gonna get me through, yeah.
Babyface had huge successes last year with the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack and the single he wrote for Eric Clapton, Change the World. But his own album is only a modest hit. There's probably a pretty simple reason for this. Babyface's voice doesn't have as much color and drama as Whitney Houston's or Madonna's. But in a quieter way, I think it has just as much power, and that the songs on the day cohere as a modulated manifesto of romanticism.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Today's edition of Fresh Air was produced by Joan Tui Westman. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tonight, I'm gonna hold you. I'm gonna touch you.